We're very happy to have as our colloquium speaker, Rafael Chavez. I hope I'm not mispronouncing that too badly, I should say. But he is a leading figure in the sort of quantum aspects or generalizations of causal inference, which is the topic of a workshop that's going on here at PI this week on causal inference and quantum foundations. He in particular is notable for working with experimenters, in particular on generalizations of Bell type experiments. Rafael did postdocs in Barcelona and Germany before beginning as a professor in 2016 at the International Institute of Physics in Natal, Brazil. And yeah, he'll introduce us to this interesting field. So whenever you're ready, Rafael, please take it away.
Hi, so I guess you can hear me. I will try to share my screen, just a second. Perfect, thanks. So yeah, I can still see you a little bit, but if there is any issue, please let me know. Yeah, so I'm happy, thanks for being here. It's a pity I'm not there, but yeah. Thanks for the organizers for the invitation for setting up this workshop. It has really worked very well in this hybrid format. So I'm very happy to be participating in it. Okay, so it's supposed to be like a talk inside this workshop, but it's open to like a broader audience. So I really try it here with this talk to be not very technical, but like try to give you an overview and a perspective on this whole field and also on my own contributions with collaborators. Okay, so let me just thank the supporters. They were really important like during this last government. Otherwise it would be impossible to do any science here in Brazil, as you might know. Okay, so starting with the topic of the talk. So if we make a quick search on the internet, we are going to see plots like these, like basically relating ice cream sales with shark attacks, forest fires, drowning deaths, violent crime index, and we see a clear correlation between them. And in particular, like around July, August, that it's a summer in the northern hemisphere, we see a peak. Okay, so I mean, we know what's going on. We don't have to blame the ice cream for all these tragedies going on here. We know that what's going on, and certainly like statisticians would never let us forget, correlation does not imply causation. So like hot weather, we are more likely to consume ice cream, but we are also like swimming in the street, in the ocean, in the pools. So all these bad things can happen. Okay, so this is easy, it's fine. It's almost trivial, but this mantra of statistics, I would say, have gone too far. So in 2008, I think like there is this article in the Wired magazine called The End of Theory, where the authors, they say things like this: correlation supersedes causation, science can advance without coherent models, theories, anything at all. Correlation is enough. So we should stop looking for models. We can analyze the data without any hypothesis. So just from the numbers, the biggest computers we ever had, and we are going to find patterns where science cannot. So, I mean, I'm a theoretician. I'm sure that most of the audience is also theoreticians, but I don't think we should be worried about that, because nothing could be further from the truth, I would say. And this is nicely illustrated in this paper by Kalu and Ongo from 2016, where they basically show that very large databases, they contain arbitrary correlations. So these correlations, they appear not because of the nature of the data, but because of its size. So they conclude most correlations are spurious. Too much information behave like very little information. So here's just like some funny examples of what would happen if you would take this no causation idea further. Soon we would be eating chihuahuas instead of cookies, and we would be using these rugged dogs instead of towels after our baths. So the point here is that if we look enough, we are always going to find patterns where there is basically noise. So I think all of us would agree that data cannot be interpreted in a theoretical vacuum. Typically, at least in physics, that it's what I know, we start with a hypothesis and only then we design an experiment and try to generate the data that is either going to confirm this hypothesis or to falsify it. Okay, everything, I think it's without debate here, but there is an issue that it's this, like it's a kind of a circular argument. I'm saying that we should start with a hypothesis and only then get the data. But where this hypothesis comes from? So it should come from data. So it's like we are always trying to find the end, but we are never really getting to it. And I would say that like, or at least is the way I see causality theory, it's a way of not only like formulating hypotheses, but also generating the data that it's going to confirm or to falsify them. So, I mean, it's a long story, but like, I would say that the modern developments, they started like in the mid 90s, in the beginning of the 90s. And now this causality theory has really had an impact on many different fields, like in medicine, ecology, biology, psychology, physics, and in the particular context of this workshop, since like 10 years or so, it also has had a very big impact on quantum field. Okay, so that's the motivation for the talk. And to address like this kind of questions that I outlined here, first we are going to talk about DAGs and the language of causality. And then I'm going to use this new language that at least I learned like, I don't know, only 10 years ago or so, like in my physics course, I certainly didn't learn how to speak this language. And now I'm going, and then I'm going to use this language to talk about very fundamental experiments in quantum physics. So starting with the double slit, then using this language to learn how we can quantify causality, both in the classical and in the quantum case. And also like talk about something that has become like a very hot topic in the recent years, that it's this idea of quantum networks. Okay, so first things first, Eisenbar's principle basically states the opposite of this mantra that correlation does not imply causation, because it says, no correlation without causation, or in perhaps less vague terms, it says that if an improbable coincidence has occurred, there must exist some direct influence and on a common cause between these two apparently coincident events. So a simple example, let's say that you go to your university like every morning, like during a whole year, and before you start working, you grab a cup of coffee and you are seeing two rooms in front of you. And always when you look for these two rooms, these two separated rooms, either the lights on them are going to be on or off, on and off, on and off. So there is a perfect correlation between these two events. And it seems very unlikely that random people always enter and leave this room at the same time. There must exist some sort of causation involved with it. Could be like some direct form of causation because of some bad wiring in the wall. Like whenever I switch on or off one light bulb, this causes the light bulb in the other room to also be turned on or off. Or it could be that everything's fine. And what's going on is that there is a third variable, for example, a short circuit that happens outside the building, and I cannot directly observe this short circuit, that it's acting as the source of correlations between these two events here. Or it could be something more mundane, like the fact that these two rooms are classrooms, and typically in universities, the time table of the classes is the same. So basically it's two classrooms. And that's the basic setup. You get data, like empirical data, lights on or off. And from those, we want to learn the causal relationships among these events. And this fits very well in a machine learning, artificial intelligence setting, because we could imagine like a machine that has sensors, it's sensing its environment. And from this information, it's able to learn something about it. Like in this case, it's going to learn causal relations. But how we do that? So there are different ways of representing causal relations. One that I particularly like and use is this idea of DAGs, that it's a directed acyclic graph. So we have a bunch of variables, x1 to xn. Each node in this graph is going to denote one of these variables, and the directed edges, they encode the causal relationships between them. And without laws of generality, at least in a classical causal model, we can always assume that a given variable, it's going to be a deterministic function of its graph theoretical parents and potentially a local noise variable. So what this means is like, for example, in this DAG here, the variable A, it has its parents lambda one and lambda two. So A is going to be a deterministic function of these two guys plus potentially a local noise variable that we don't show explicitly. And the key fact here is that the causal relationships, they are encoded in the conditional independences that are implied by the graph. So what this means? And these conditional independences, we can just read them from the graph. So for example, the variables lambda one and lambda two, they do not have an arrow going from one to the other, neither there is common cause between them. So they should be causally independent and also statistically independent. And this means that whatever is the physical mechanism that is generating these two variables, the probability of them should factorize. Another possible conditional independence here is the fact that A and B, in general, they are going to be correlated because they have a common cause. It's this variable lambda one. But if you condition on this variable, these correlations, they should disappear. So the correlations between A and B, they are screened off. Okay, great. So we know how to represent causal relations. Now let's see what we can do with them. And here we can think of two kinds of problems. One that it's very hard and relates to this circular arguments that I mentioned before. It's what we call causal discovery. So from data, really come up with a DAG, with a causal structure or a set of causal structures that can explain that data. Here, I'm going to go to the easier, but still very hard question, that it's what we call causal compatibility. So for some reason, I have some hypothesis, for example, that my data is generated by a causal structure like this one here. And now I want to, from the data, be able to either falsify it or to confirm this hypothesis. So how I do that? So let's say that I have the joint probability distribution of all the variables that are here in my data. Then basically what I have to do is to check the conditional independences that are implied by this causal structure. If all of them are fulfilled, great, I have a compatibility. If at least one of them is not fulfilled, then I have just falsified this causal structure as a possible causal explanation for my data. So this is very nice, but in practice, it's not so useful because in most cases, we are not going to have access to all the variables that might be important in a given experiment. So this means that some of these variables we have to treat as latent factors, as hidden variables. The most famous example of that, I would say, or at least for physicists, it's Bell's theorem, that basically we are going to impose this causal structure here for experiment, and we want to see if the correlations that we generate when this classical variable here is replaced by a quantum variable, by a quantum state, if we can still explain via this classical causal model the quantum correlations that we generate. And we know that the answer is no. So here, like we have Alice and Bob, they are very far apart, like I did, space-like separated. They receive physical systems that are being generated by the source here. At each run of the experiment, they flip a coin, X for Alice, Y for Bob, that decides which measurement they are going to take, like a position or momentum, or the polarization of a photon, like in different directions. And the whole point here is that we assume this variable lambda here to be hidden, to be a latent factor. First, because we might not have like a full description of all the degrees of freedom of our source. And if we are thinking of like trying to complement quantum mechanics with some sort of hidden variables, by definition, we don't have access to them. So what we have access empirically it's this observable distribution here, P of AB given XY. But the point is that the causal relations implied by this DAG, they are encoded in these conditional independences, these and many more, that involve explicitly the variable lambda, but I don't have access to this variable lambda. So I have to eliminate lambda from my description. So just to give you a glimpse of what these relations here mean, so x, y, and lambda, their distributions should factorize. This comes from the fact that we don't have arrows among these variables, neither like a common source among all of them. And this here, it's what we would call freedom of choice. So like Alice and Bob, they can choose which experiment they want to do independently of how the source has been prepared. This other one here is basically saying that whatever Alice is going to observe in her lab should be independent of whatever Bob is doing in his own lab, because they are space-like separated. So we believe Einstein, this should not happen. And similarly, like we have many others. But the point again is that we cannot test these conditions directly because we do not have empirical access to the variable lambda. So we eliminate it from our description. Technically, we do that via what we call a quantifier elimination. But the end of the story is that after I eliminate these variable from my system of equations, basically what I get, it's a projection in this real space, and it's going to define a set of correlations. It's this gray area here that it's compatible with my hypothetical causal structure. And the boundaries of this set, it's exactly what we call Bell inequality. So what is a Bell inequality? It's nothing else than the observable constraints that follow from a causal model with hidden variables, nothing else than that. And now if I do a quantum experiment and I observe a point in this space that lies outside this gray set, we see that it's going to violate the Bell inequality, so I can witness the incompatibility of this causal explanation with the data that I have generated. Okay, so it's very simple. It's convex in this case. We know how to do that. Like we had done that for like 50 years or more. The problem is that if you go beyond this causal structure here, things get much more complicated. And the reason, so here it's like this triangle again that we have seen over and over in this workshop. And why it's so difficult, this kind of scenario, because now we are going to treat these hidden variables here, lambda one, lambda two, and lambda three. These are the hidden variables in this case. They are independent. So this means that their probability distribution factorizes. And because of these nonlinear conditions here, the sets that these causal structures that they define are going to be non-convex. Typically, in generality, we need to use algebraic geometry methods, and they are crazy expensive, like computationally. So even scenarios like this, you cannot solve in a computer. So this is like how a non-convex set might look like. But over the last years, we have really, and the community as a whole have developed a lot of new tools to characterize at least partially this sort of causal structure, this sort of non-convex sets. So here's just a very incomplete list of references. Okay, so that's the basic setup, like the language I have introduced, like what is the basic problem. I didn't explain, but we have a lot of tools to try to solve this problem. Now let's look at possible applications of this language of causality. So some years ago, I think it was 2017, after reading many books and papers on causal inference, we said, well, okay, let's now try to apply this to the most paradigmatic and at the same time simple quantum experiment we can think of. And then the first thing that comes to mind, it's the famous double slit experiment. And then we had like a theory paper, and then afterwards with the collaboration of Fabio, we did a photonic experiment with these theory ideas. Okay, so what's the double slit experiment? I'm going to talk about this because there is in the audience like people from computer science and other areas that might not know what this double slit experiment is. But we can use here like the famous phrase of the famous Feynman, who said once that I will take just one experiment which has been designed to contain all the mystery of quantum mechanics. Any other situation, it turns out, can always be explained by saying, remember the case of this experiment with the two holes, it's the same thing. So when we started this project, we agreed with Feynman. But by the end of it, we allowed ourselves to disagree with him. And I must say, this is quite something. I mean, it's maybe the only time that I was allowed to disagree with him. But so what's this double zeta experiment? Basically, I have a source of physical systems, like could be thermal light, like photons, electrons, ping pong balls, it doesn't matter. So they are emitted here. And here I have a screen that has like two holes on it, like two slits through which these physical systems they can pass. And here I have a detection screen where like these physical systems are detected. And then if I do this experiment, for example, with usual light, and this was what Young did like many years ago to prove that light is indeed a wave, what we observe is that we are going to have an interference pattern. So like a region where the light is more intense, and this corresponds to like a constructive interference, and regions where the light is very dimmed or there is no light. So this is a destructive interference. Okay, so this is like 200 years old. What happens now if I send, for instance, like photons, like particles of light or electrons? Then we see that we are going to send them like one by one, and we detect here over time these electrons. So we see that they leave this mark in the screen. It's something we would expect from a particle. But as we take more and more data, we see that very clearly interference pattern is going to emerge here. So like regions where the electrons will fall more often and regions where they don't fall. So somehow the electron that is that we understand as a particle can also behave as a wave. So this is the so-called wave particle duality. And what is more is that this data here, this pattern can change depending on how we do this experiment. And what I mean with that is, if we don't try to see through which slit the electrons have passed, then what we are going to see is this interference pattern. But now if we try to get the information about which path is electrons are passing, then this interference pattern disappears, and then we get something that we would expect from like a particle-like behavior, like two hues here behind each of these two slits. Okay, so now we can make another twist to this story, and this was done by a Wheeler that, if I'm not mistaken, was the supervisor of Feynman. And then he said, well, okay, it could be that the electron at the source knows whether we are going to see through which slit it's passing or not. So like before we do the experiment, the electron decides what's going to be, particle or wave. But then Wheeler said, well, and if we decide whether we want to detect through which slit the electron has passed only after it has passed through these slits, then it could not know beforehand which kind of experiment we are going to perform. And this is what we call a delayed choice experiment. So let's map this now to something that it's much easier to do in the lab with photons. And instead of a double slit, we have now what we call a Mach-Zehnder interferometer. So here we have a source of single photons. Instead of the double slits, we have here a beam splitter that it's basically send the photon in this path or in this path here, like with probability 50%. Between the two arms here of the interferometer, I might have a phase between them. And here at the end, I have my measurement station that it's composed of a second beam splitter that might be present or not. So if I don't put this second beam splitter here, then the photon that's coming through here, it's going to be detected down here, and the photon that is coming here, it's going to be detected here. So this is what we would expect from a particle. But if the second beam splitter is here, these two paths, they're going to interfere. And now if I adjust this phase here, I might get the photon always clicking here. So this would mean like a constructive interference, or never clicking here. And this would correspond to destructive interference. So it's a very simple photonic setup that in the modern language of quantum information, we call a prepare and measure scenario. So like basically this first part here is a source, this photon and this phase would correspond to a preparation device that it's preparing a given physical system. And this down part here, the second beam splitter and these two detectors would be your detection device. Okay, and now we can go on one step further. And what is the underlying causal structure of this prepare and measure? It's this causal structure here that it's extremely simple. Basically, I have my X variable that it's telling me what is the state that I'm going to prepare. And in a classical description, this guy here is going to be a random variable, lambda, a hidden variable lambda. And here I'm going to detect or not the photon. And of course, this is going to depend on the state of the photon and whether or not I'm going to put the second beam splitter here. Okay, so it's very simple. Can we use this causal model, this classical causal model, to explain the observed statistics in the double zeta experiment? And surprisingly for us, the answer is yes. I'm not going to enter in the details here, but it's really simple. But let me just say that if we don't have the second beam splitter, then the state just before the detectors, it's going to be something like this, a superposition of the 0-1 with the 1-0 state. So either the photon going here or there, and there is this phase here that it's the difference in length, let's say, of the two arms. And if I do have the second beam splitter, then I just need to make a transformation here to my state. And the state that I'm going to have, it's something like this, like 0-1, 1-0. But with this cos and sine, and adjusting here this phase, phi, I can get like this constructive or destructive interference. And then, so this is the data that we generate in this experiment. And it's very easy to show that a causal model of this kind here, with this choice of parameters, can reproduce the data of this experiment. So what I'm saying here is that contrary to Feynman, there is no mystery here. This is classical. So no, quantum mechanics cannot be reduced to the double slit. And what I'm doing here, it's really like subtle, I would say, because I'm forgetting about these weird concepts of particle and wave or wave-particle duality. What I'm defining as classical here is to have a classical causal model that might reproduce my data. So this is what I'm calling classical. But we can make another twist here, and we can make this experiment non-classical if we slightly change it. So instead of putting in and out is a second beam splitter, I'm always going to let this beam splitter there. But before here, before the photon is detected, I'm going to add an extra phase. So now it's a phase that will depend here on the coin that I'm flipping. And in this situation here, I can detect the non-classicality. And how I do that? Because now if I limit the dimension of this variable here, and I'm going to explain why I'm going to do that, then this model, it's not trivial anymore. Meaning that they are going to be like Bell-like inequalities that are going to bound this kind of causal structure. And single photons can violate these inequality, hence like proving their non-classicality. But why I'm bounding the dimension here? Well, let's think. It's a single photon that can be in one arm or in the other. So I can at most send one bit of information, right? So it's reasonable to say that a fair comparison between a classical and a quantum model should have this classical variable here, assuming like at most two possible values, so being a bit. And the other thing that it's interesting here is that if I want to simulate the data that I generate in this quantum, in this new quantum experiment, with a classical causal model, then I would need something like this, that it's exactly hetero causality. Like somehow the choices of what I'm going to do with the photon in the future should somehow be affecting how this photon has been prepared in the past. So this is what takes to explain like quantum futures, quantum features with classical quantum model. Okay, so this was the first example. Let me just drink some water here. Let's talk now about how I can use this causality framework to quantify classical as well as quantum causality. So we are back here to the very basic question of causal inference. So I have some data, some two variables, and I want to know if the correlations that I observe between these two variables are due to causal influences or to some common cause. So we know, like we have data that smoking correlates with like the development of cancer. But we know that correlation is not causation. So it makes sense to say, is it really the case that smoking causes cancer? Because it could be that there is here like some sort of a common cause between these two events. Like in the 60s, in the 50s, children would like watch TV and see advertisements like this, Marlboro Man or like doctors smoke Camels. But at the same time, they would be like exposed to electromagnetic radiation. So it could be that not only the children would be more likely to smoke, but also to develop a disease later on. Another more recent kind of question that comes from social networks, it's whether obesity is contagious or not. So like analyzing data from social networks, people have seen that if you are a friend of an obese person, you are more likely over time to also become, to gain some weight. And this could be because of some direct causal influence. Like your friend likes to eat a lot of chocolate cake, you start eating a lot of it too, and then you get obese later on. But it could be the other way around, that actually the reason why you became friend of this person at the first place is because you already like to eat too much chocolate cake. So over time, you would gain weight like independently of being friend of this person or not. And the basic question here is this: how can I distinguish these two cases? And in general, we can't. And the reason is very simple. Like what we are trying to do is to say, the correlations that I observe between A and B, they are due to this causal arrow here, or because of this common cause A and B between both of them. And this common cause is not observable. This cause might be there or not. And both models, like both this arrow and this common cause, they generate the same set of correlations between A and B. So I cannot distinguish them. But I can now distinguish them if instead of just observing, I can now intervene in my system. And with an intervention, I mean the following. So now I force my variable A to assume a value that it's under my control and like independently of the rest of the universe. And I can do that like locally. This means like without changing anything else in my causal structure. So you see that like an intervention on A is like erasing all the incoming edges that come to A, but without changing the outgoing edges. So this is what we call do A, of like doing A, of forcing A to be under my control. And you see that if I still observe correlations between A and B in this case, now the only way that A and B can be correlated, it's through this path. It's through the direct causal influence from A to B. So this means that observations are different from interventions. Like the probability that I observe B, given that I observed A, it's different from the probability of B, given that I do A, that I intervene on A. And it's also nice that it defines a natural measure of causality. It's not the only one, but it's one that it's very intuitive, that it's what we call ACE, so like the average causal effect. So this here doesn't matter, like there are different ways of defining this here instead of this supremum could be a average. But the point here is that So let's say that A has no causal influence over B. So like independently of intervening on A and forcing it to be A or A prime, if there is no causal error here, then B should not change. So this should be equal to this and the A should be equal to zero. But if A does have some influence over B, then depending on what I do with A, I'm going to change the value of B, and this A is quantifying, okay? So very simple. But the basic problem, it's still not solved, because what I'm saying now is this, okay, I want to know if smoking causes cancer or not. It's very simple. I just take two group of people, I put them in a cage, I force one group to smoke two packs of cigarettes for 10 years, I see what happens. The other group, I don't force to do that, and I see what happens. So I mean, theoretically, it's nice, but in practice, of course, we cannot do that. So the basic question still remains, can we infer causality without the need of forcing people to smoke? And the answer is yes, and this is something that we've heard a lot during the workshop, the so-called instrumental variables. So what I do now is that I introduce extra variable X. So I have the same thing as before, A that might cause B, and there might be some common cause here between them. I introduce this new variable X that it's my instrumental variable. And this variable has some causal influence over A, but does not have any correlation with lambda. Neither it has a direct causal influence over B. But notice now that I'm not doing an intervention. I'm not forcing A to listen only to me. A is still listening to the variable lambda. So I'm back in an observational scenario where now I'm looking for the correlations between A and B, given that my instrumental variable assumed a value or other. So like just to give an example, this variable X could be like a tobacco taxation by a government. So if smoking causes cancer, and I basically give cigarettes for free in school, more people are going to smoke. And of course, if this error is there, more people are going to develop cancer later on. And if I do the opposite and I make I ban cigarettes or I make them very expensive, over time, I should see a decrease in the number of in the cases of lung cancer. Okay, so that's the basic ideas, like the intuition, why these instrumental variables might help. But then in 97, Balk and Pearl, they did this very concrete. I mean, people before them did this also, but what they did here, it's what we would call like in a fully device independent setting. So basically what they showed was the following, that we can bound this interventional quantity, that is the ACE, because I'm intervening in the system, but I can bound this interventional quantity by looking at the observational data. In particular, I can bound this average causal effect by this observational data here, meaning that I can estimate what is going to happen if I force people to smoke without actually forcing them to smoke. So it's a very powerful counterfactual reasoning. And of course, this became like widespread in many different disciplines. And in fact, in 2021, so we heard earlier today about the Nobel Prize in physics from last year of Bell and Nefalis. And in 2021, we had this Nobel Prize in economics to these three gentlemen here. And in particular, Engrist and Imbens, they received their share of the prize because of their work in particular using instrumental variables as a way of identifying and quantifying causal effects. So it's something that it's really powerful. But then, and there is always like a then, what happens if we put quantum mechanics into this picture? Because so far, I'm only talking about the classical cause and effect relationships. And we know since Bell's theorem that things change radically if we put entanglement in. Okay, so this is what we started to ask ourselves like some 5 years ago. Here's like some of the papers that we get that we got, like the theory and experimental papers. And in the rest of the talk, I'm going to discuss a few of the results. Okay, so let's again start with the instrumental semantic. So in this paper from 2014, Hanson Law and Puzzi, they proved the following, that if X, A, and B, that are the observable variables, they are dichotomic, so they assume the values are 0, 1, then all the correlations that can generate here will always have a classical explanation. It doesn't matter if I put entangled state here, a PR box, or like whatever weird thing. Always it will be the case that I can explain the data that I generate, P of A, B, given X, by a classical model, by assuming that this guy here is a random variable, and so on and so forth. But what happens now about interventional data? Can still be the case that at the observational level, I do have a classical explanation, but not at the interventional level. So here it's the description of what an intervention would do, like in classical terms, and just erasing the arrows that come to A. And here is the quantum description. So what is a quantum intervention on A? Well, A, it's defined as a random variable, as the value that measurement on this quantum system is going to take. So the most general intervention I can think of here, I'm basically tracing out the state that Alice has shared with Bob. She prepares a new and independent state, and she's going to measure this state. So this is the most general intervention that we can think of. And in particular, from the point of view of Bob, he doesn't know what's going on, if Alice is doing an intervention or if she's just measuring her system as usual. So from the perspective of Bob, we are going to continue to use here like a Born's rule to compute the probability of B, given that Alice erased this link here that correlated Alice with Bob via the common source. Okay, so the question is this. Can this be valid in the sense that I do have a classical explanation at the observational level, but not at the interventional level? And how can we test that? Well, we can use the causal bound of Perl, because I'm going to assume, or I'm going to use a data, an observational data on the right-hand side that does have a classical explanation. But if I violate this bound here, this means that at the interventional level, there is no classical explanation anymore. And I'm going to show an example here. Okay, so let's say that Alice and Bob, they share a state of this form. So with some visibility V, I have a maximum entangled state, and with the complement, I just have a white noise. So if we trace out the Alice's qubit here, basically what we are going to have for Bob, it's identity over two. And if the measurements that Bob is doing, they are projective, then the probability of getting spin up or down or spin to right or left or diagonal and anti-diagonal are always going to be half, because the state that he has in his possession is just identity over two. So this means that, like, independently of what Alice might do in her system, what Bob is going to observe in his side, it's always going to be the same. So the A's, if the state that they share is a maximum entangled state or a state like this, the ace is going to be zero. But now with the same state, instead of doing an intervention on Alice, I can just do like the usual kind of Bell test. Alice is going to measure some observable on her side, and Bob is going to measure an observable on his side. So they generate observational data. And now we plug in these two things together here. On the left side, interventional data. On the right side, observational data. And what we see is that for a high enough visibility, we are going to violate this bound. Because if we would do an intervention, we would see that the ace is zero. But this classical bound is telling us that the ace for, let's say, V equal to one, this should be larger than zero. So in practice, what this is showing is two things. Only looking at the observational data, it's not enough to conclude something about the classicality or not. We have to look also at the interventional data. And more generally, what this is showing is that quantum effects can lead to an overestimation of causal influences. So this has like a practical consequences as well. Okay, so we can go beyond that and prove some sort of Gisand's theorem for interventions. So we can actually prove that every pure entangled state can violate this bound here. So every pure entangled state can lead to an overestimation of causal influences. The other thing we can do now is to say, well, okay, so this bound here of Perl is based on classical physics. Can we derive a bound like this, but now for quantum physics, or perhaps even for something beyond quantum physics? And the answer is yes. So I'm not going to enter in the technical details here, but we can derive this sort of ugly expressions here that is going to bound how much causal influence I can have, not only in classical theories, but in quantum theories, or I can even go beyond that in post-quantum theories. And here it's like just a slice in the probability space, and it shows the following. So this blue region here that also includes this red region is the region in this probability space where the classical ways is going to be larger than zero. So if I'm here or if I'm there, the classical ways would be larger than zero. But you see that there is a gap to the region where the quantum ways is different of zero because the region of the quantum is smaller. And I can also do something for non-signaling theories. And the nice thing is this, it's that this gap that typically we see when we talk about observations between different theories like classical, quantum, and post-quantum also is reflected at the level of intervention. So we did this experimentally, and this experiment, I must say, it was really nice because we have here an optical switcher that allow us to decide in real time whether Alice is going to do a usual measurement or if she's going to do intervention. So like in real time, we can decide which kind of data is going to be generated. Then we generate like observational data and interventional data. We put them here in the inequality, and we see that we can violate the inequality. So like here, for example, in these dots here are the dot. It's what we get if we actually do an intervention in our experiment. So like the ACE is going to be close to zero. And these points here, this upper curve, it's what we would get using the classical bound. So we see that what we get, it's below the classical bound, hence we have a violation. Okay, so nice. How much time I still have? Just to know if I enter the details of these quantum networks or not. And in any case, if you have any questions, I'm happy to take them.
Well, I guess we're aiming to end by 3.
Okay, so I still have 8 minutes.
Yeah.
Okay, perfect. Quantum networks. Yeah, so here it's the causal structure that underlies Bell's theorem, LS1, LS2, they are far apart. They can choose what they want to measure. And then we can say, well, how can we generalize Bell to other causal structures? And for 30 years or so, these were these sort of things that we did. Like basically we said, now we have 3, 4, 5 parties and we have a source of multipartite entanglement between them, like let's say a JZ scenario. So this is okay, it has a lot of applications, but conceptually doesn't bring really anything new as compared to this simple causal structure. Because in all cases, we have like this kind of single source connects all scenarios. But like with these ideas from DAGs and causal inference and these sort of things, like people started to look for other generalizations. And one of them, I think maybe it's the first of them, at least the one I'm aware, it's this paper by Francière, Gisand, and Pironi in 2010, where instead of looking at something boring where I have a single source, they look at what we call now the bilocal scenario, where I have two sources, and the independence of these two sources is explicitly taken into account. And this defines a non-convex set, so like the set of classical correlations compatible with this model would be these curved things here. And here's like some experiment we did with Fabio generating a point that lies outside this set. hence showing experimentally that we can also detect non-classicality in this sort of networks. But why we want to do that? And I mean, this was not so clear in the beginning, like 13 years ago, I would say, but now we have a much better picture. And looking at these quantum networks, like beyond Bell, really unlocks like new features of quantum mechanics. So, for example, in this paper here, it was proven that if we have classical measurement devices, in the sense that if you take this measurement device and put in a usual Bell network, it's always going to generate classical statistics. But now if you take this same device and you put here into a network, you are going to activate the non-classicality, the non-locality of this measurement device. Monday or Tuesday, we heard Miriam talking a little bit of how we can use this network here to make self-testing of quantum theory. In this other paper, they used the same network to prove that the predictions of quantum mechanics require complex numbers. So we cannot explain the quantum predictions with real quantum mechanics. And in this other paper, like they define, this is something we heard about today, we can get new definitions of what are full network non-locality. Or we can move to, this is the star, well, actually it's a triangle, but it's the star of the community since some years ago, that it's the triangle. And some of the new features that we can see with this kind of causal structure is the fact that we can have non-locality without the need of inputs. And this is something that it's really fundamental, I would say, because if we think of the usual Bell scenario, we need that Alice, Bob, and Charlie, they always change what's the kind of experiment that they are going to perform. But here, Alice 1, 2, and 3, Alice, Bob, and Charlie, they always perform the same experiment. And even like this, we can still reveal non-classicality. This sort of scenarios also define new notions of multipartite non-locality. And as we have shown in a recent paper, these kind of scenarios allow us to talk about, not to solve, but at least to talk about a loophole in Bell's theorem that until then, I would say it was like, we could not speak about, that it's the freedom of choice loophole. So now at least we have ways of quantifying these experimentally and this sort of thing. So it's also like another nice feature of this triangle scenario. So I don't want to pass my time, so I'm not going to enter in the details here. But just to say that recently, in collaboration with Ellie, with Prof. Peckens, and the group of Fabio in Rome, we realized it experimentally, this triangle network, and we were able to prove the non-classicality of the data. And it was a very nice project because we had to learn a lot of new tools. So in order to detect non-classicality of the data, we had to derive new and ugly entropic Bell. Well, actually, it's like a mixed Bell inequalities because we have entropy terms and probability terms. We used these techniques of Gizan's group in Geneva of using neural networks to detect whether or not the data is can have a classical explanation or not. And of course, we also use the inflation technique of Ellie, Peckens, and Tobias Fritz to, and you see that it's a really big inflation, so it was a really hard problem to see whether the data that we generated in this quantum network here, in this quantum triangle network, would be deemed classical or not. So it's a very recent paper that was out like some weeks ago. Okay, so I come to the end of my talk. I hope you will take this message home. So causality theory provides really a fairly unexplored framework in the foundations of quantum physics. Like even very simple things like the double slit experiment can show us some surprises. The other important message here is that for 50 years, we looked at observational data. Now we should also start looking at interventional data, because as I showed, these interventions can reveal non-classicality where pure observations cannot. And causal networks, like either the triangle or the bilocal scenario, they really can reveal new quantum features, some of them that were thought to be impossible before. So with that, I end with invitation for all of you to come to Paraty in August. So it's going to be the 80th edition of this workshop that since some years is the biggest in Latin America. I'm sure that many of you in the audience, Rob, he was a lecturer there many years ago, I remember. We had a nice conversation in a boat trip. Yeah, so the registration is open, so hope to see you there, and I'm happy to take questions. So thank you.
All right, thanks. That was a great talk. So any questions either in the room or online? Maybe I'll start with one. So you mentioned in the last part that this triangle geometry gets around the sort of choice of observation basis and loophole in the Bell test. Could you just say so normally there's this loophole in the conclusion that Bell implies no local hidden variables, that if the experimenter is not really freely making the choice about which basis to measure in.
Yes.
Are you saying this geometry lets you draw that conclusion without that loophole?
To partially address this loophole. And the reason for that, without entering too much technicalities here, so it's what we call the Fritz argument. So here's the triangle. But now let's basically, so now it's a triangle where the observed nodes are composed of two bits, a zero, a one, the zero and the one. And the first step, I open this box here, and now I say that a zero, and I'm allowed to do that, a zero is a cause of a one, okay? And the zero is the cause of the one. So I get this ugly causal structure here that it's still the triangle if I treat a zero and a one together. But now I can see the following, like I can derive an entropic inequality here that shows me that if this variable here, a zero, has perfect correlations with C zero and B zero has perfect correlations with C one, then, for example, a zero cannot depend in any way on the variable lambda ab. So I go now to this simpler DAG here, where lambda ab does not have anymore an edge to a zero and to b zero, and I can drop this edge because if a zero has maximum correlations with c zero, you can prove that it cannot depend on any way on this variable. And if now I just trace out C0 and C1 out of my DAG, I basically get here the Bell's causal structure, where A0 is the input to Alice and B0 is the input to Bob. Okay, so what I said so far is basically that inside this triangle causal structure, we do have the Bell one. But now we can do something much more powerful. That is to say, well, what happens if a zero is actually not perfectly correlated with C zero? So this would then mean that a zero might have some influences from lambda AB. So I'm now in a Bell scenario where I'm allowing for edges for like causal influences from the source into the measurement choices, because now if A0 is not perfectly correlated with C0, this edge might be there. And what we managed to prove in this paper here, is that you can test non-classicality, you can test the violation of a Bell inequality, even in situations where you explicitly have measurement dependence. So, I mean, the point is that we don't have to assume that we have measurement independence. This is going to be treated by the own data and these crazy inequalities that we have here. So, but of course that this doesn't come for free. So what is the assumption here? We don't have to assume free will anymore. We don't have to assume a freedom of choice anymore, but we do have to assume that these three sources are actually independent. So the assumption now is that there are sources of correlations in the universe that are truly independent of each other. And if you can assume that, then freedom of choice loophole is not a problem anymore. So I hope it's clear.
Yeah, so have you considered doing some astronomical implementation of this with three very widely separated quasars as the sources or something like that?
Well, the point is that we don't need, right? Because now we can just make so what's the reason of using like a human randomness or like using a light from quasars? It's exactly to make this arrow here as unlikely as possible to say, well, if you want to have this sort of no freedom of choice explanation, then the light that you are observing today, then the light that was emitted by a star like 1 billion years ago should be correlated with the laser that is generating the light that you measure now. But in this new sort of scenario, we don't need to do that. We only have to implement this triangle causal structure. We don't need to make any assumptions at all about like measurement independence or freedom of choice or anything. And the data will tell us if the if there is a model without freedom of choice that will explain our data or not. And we actually did this experiment. So not using lights from quasars, but like usual quantum random number generators. And yes, and indeed we can violate the Bell inequality without assuming freedom of choice, but we have to assume that the three sources we use in our experiment are indeed independent.
Yes, I see. So thank you. Sorry. Yeah, you're right. Okay, thanks. Yes, Rob.
Hi, Raphael. Thanks for the talk. So I have a question, but first I would just mention for Latham's question, the way I understood it was that, you know, if we wanted some evidence that there's, you know, some quantum effects in astrophysics and we're just, you know, getting photons from distant sources, then previously the conventional wisdom would be, oh, well, you know, if I think of those photons as sort of outcomes, I haven't got any ability to manipulate settings. But if I had a situation where I had sort of three sources of photons, which I consider my three outcomes, and good astrophysical reasons to think that the causal structure was that there's no three-way common cause of these sources, but only two-way common causes, then I could look at the correlations between those three sources and say, aha, this is inconsistent with that causal structure, but consistent with a quantum explanation. So I've just seen quantum effects out there, and I didn't need to do it in the lab here on Earth.
So, right.
That was okay, the spirit of your question.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you can do that, but I don't know if the light that it's being emitted by quasar is entangled, but I guess not, I don't know.
What I would say is like, if there are lasers out there that are kind of, not lasers necessarily, but sort of coherent sources of quantum entanglement out there in the universe that are organized into a triangle, and we're getting sort of classical information about what we would normally call the outcomes, we could attest to the presence of entanglement in you know, far reaches of the universe.
Right.
Just by looking at correlations, just by observational data, no need for any interventions as we normally would have in a Bell experiment. So you might have said, oh, observational astronomy, no possibility of doing any really strong tests of non-classicality there, because we all know that, you know, Bell theorem requires you to have setting variables. Not the case, because we have these.
So it's true. Like this reminds me of a paper that tried to use this cosmic radiation background to violate the Bell inequality. And the problem that the guy had there was exactly that it was very difficult to define settings, like different observables. But then you are right. Like, if you can assume that like these regions are some, well, yeah. So you can just use your idea and look for the cosmic radiation background and see if you can violate the Baryonic or not. I mean, this would be very cool. Yeah.
Okay, so onto my question, if I may. So when you were talking about witnessing non-classicality by looking at both the observational and the interventional data in the instrumental scenario, it occurred to me that, I mean, here you're focusing on two ways of probing A. You know, A is a classical variable. I could just passively observe it, or I could forget about the value it would naturally take and reset it to little a or little a prime. But of course, there's more general kinds of interventions. I could act a function on it before passing it on to the next lab, or I could add some noise to it. So this whole space and in the process matrix formalism or the Combs formalism, I can think of A as sort of a gap in the wire, and I can feed in anything there. And so I was just wondering to what extent you've thought about, what's the strongest witness of non-classicality? Like, if I vary over all different kinds of probing schemes on A, what's my best chance of seeing the non-classicality? Is it necessarily just by focusing on the observational and the hard interventional data that you talk about here?
So in the case of the instrumental scenario, I think yes. I don't have a proof, but I mean, it's just so simple that there are not really many things you can do there. But so this is something that we started working with Davide. It's what we call partial interventions. So now you don't need to make, as you say, a hard intervention. You can make a soft one. And by doing that, we believe, we still don't have the final results, but we have strong reasons to believe that you might get the new constraints that you don't get from observation, neither from hard interventions. So I think this is the next frontier that we would like to explore. And I think it might be very useful okay. as a way of detecting on classicality. So yes, it's something we are thinking about, and we still don't have a perfect name, but we are calling this partial intervention.
Hello, Rafael, thank you for the talk. So can you explain again why in the late choice experiment, you were making this assumption that the hidden variable had only cardinality 2? I think I missed it.
So, I mean, if we don't assume anything on the cardinality of lambda, this whole structure is trivial, right? Like, there is nothing you can hope to detect non-classicality there. And in particular, this is what we showed, right? Like, that you take this data and it has a classical explanation. But so you have to add some sort of constraint to make this non-trivial. And then what we are adding here as a constraint is a dimension constraint. And so like when we compare a classical versus a quantum causal model, we should try to make this comparison as fair as possible for both sides, right? So here, like I do have a single flaw. So I'm not looking at any other degree of freedom of this photon, the orbital angular momentum, the time gain, or anything like this. I'm only looking at the degree of freedom, whether the photon is in one arm or in the other arm. So this is a qubit, right? Like, it encodes at most one bit of classical information. So the idea here is that what's the fair comparison for the classical model? Well, is to say that the classical simulation of this experiment should use here a message, a carrier that has the same dimension as the quantum system it's supposed to simulate. So we are assuming that this classical variable has at most dimension 2. So if we think now of three arms, then we would have a treat. Then we would say here, well, we can have now the states 0, 1, and 2. So this is the typical the typical assumption that we do when we are in this so-called prepare and measure scenario. You always assume something about the dimension of the state that it's being prepared. And here, I would say it's a fair comparison to compare a qubit with a bit. So that's the basic idea. So you can interpret the violation of this inequality in two ways. Either you need to have a retro causality, or you need to have a classical random variable that takes more than two values. These two interpretations are okay.
Okay.
Does it answer your...
Yes, but then a follow-up question. So when you wrote down your hidden variable model for like to explain the quantum predictions, are you aiming to interpret this hidden variable as saying I have a particle that is either in one arm or in the other arm? And the hidden variable says
so
in which arm?
I from scratch, I negate the particle and wave concepts. I'm not a physicist anymore. I'm a causality theoretician. For me, like classicality means having or not a classical causal explanation. So in no way I can interpret this, at least we didn't try to interpret this here in terms of, maybe you could, it's a good question, but we never tried to interpret what are these response functions here in terms of these concepts of wave and particle. We didn't do it. I don't know if it's going to be possible or if it's going to be meaningful. But it's a good question. I don't know.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, if there are no further questions, that's a great time to stop. Let's thank Rafael one more time for a terrific talk.
Bye, everyone. Thank you.